Hello everyone, let's wait another minute or two for people to arrive. Okay, let's get started. Welcome everyone to the monthly ET Telecon of June 2019. The main topic we have today is kind of two updates from working groups of the site evaluation parameters. So Jan Harms leads this kind of team. Actually, it's four teams for the site evaluation parameters. I guess people are aware there are four different groups there. Working group one deals with data storage, code and information sharing. We won't hear from them today. Working group two is for sensor installations to do environmental monitoring. We will hear from Federico about them today. Then we have the working group three, which is on the site conditions, geology, hydrology, the environment, and so on. And then working group four is on the environmental noise estimations, so not measuring, but kind of seeing what levels of Newtonian noise, seismic noise, magnetic noise, and so on you would actually see. Can I ask people to, if you're not speaking, to actually mute your microphones? I see currently open is Jean, René, and Andrea. Thank you. And with that, I think I hand over to Federico Paletti. I put the link to the slides in the bottom, and over to Federico, who I assume is in the EGO meeting room. Is that right?
Yes, okay. Hello, everybody. Do you hear us?
Yes, now we hear you. Thank you.
Okay, here in EGO, there is Valerio Boschi with me, and maybe Rene is just a little bit later, but she come soon. But we can start from the slide. I guess that everyone have to look at the slide by himself, and the slides are numbered, so I can say the number of the slide is okay?
Yes, exactly. That should work fine.
Okay, perfect. So. Starting from slide number one is simply a report on the main sensors we have evaluated for the seismic. Slide number two, seismic, acoustic, and magnetic measurement to be performed for the ET site evaluation. Clearly, there are more other sensors we can think of, but these are the most important for the time being. And of the three, the most important of the three is the seismic sensors. So what we want to measure is the ambient noise, the Newtonian noise, slide number three, the background seismicity, the effect of large regional and teleseismic earthquakes. It's quite important to say that we think that we have to measure at least for 1 year, maybe 2 years of data taking, because for having more information on this kind of noise, it is necessary, it is needed to have long-term measurement. So this is quite important. As you can see here on the plot, this is a seismic percentile at Vigo site. This is based on 1 year of data. On slide number four, there is the what we say installation best practice, because in order to obtain good results for low frequency measurement, is really, really important to follow some rules installing seismometers. So some are obvious clearly, but only the experienced people that works on these kind of topics know very well how to use this kind of sensor. That they must install far from sources of local noise, like fans, car, equipment and plants. This is about the surface installation. And about the underground installation, they must have a good cohesion with bedrock, and they must be shielded from air circulation and thermal variation. As you can see in the figure on the left of the slide, there are many, many layers of thermal insulation, and there is a very good contact with the ground. In slide number four, there is a tentative costs of this sensor. We will see later some more detail, but we are talking of about 25 kilo euro per each station, then some other costs for the site preparation. It is important to have what I told before, a good deployment, because we want to prevent to record the installation noise masking the true seismic signal. Then in slide number six, we talk about the sound measurement. What we want to measure, what we think is important to measure, is clearly the acoustic noise over time at the surface, the underground reverberation time of the cavern, and also, if any, the noise of the air flux for air circulation in the cavern, because sometimes this is the dominant noise inside underground inside cavern. So it's depend if there is any air conditioning system, air flowing system or not. In the upper left plot, you can see, for example, that the blue curve is an underground spectrum in Sardinia, and what you see mostly is the sensor noise, because we reached the sensor noise. This is not the noise we can use, is the one we had at the time of the measurement. So we can also use more sensitive microphone. Maybe it's not necessary, because maybe it's depending where we go to measure, there will be other kind of noise arising from air circulation. The red plot instead is the Virgo quietest room, that is the laser lab clean room. So there is what seems a lot of noise more respect to underground, but indeed is a very quiet place. About the reverberation time, is interesting to have it, because you can learn something about the reverberation, exploding some firecrackers, you know the reverberation time, and so you can learn something more about the distribution of modal notes, acoustic notes into the cavern. Slide number seven, also for sound, there are installation best practice. When you are outside, you need a protection against direct water and wind. This is mandatory, because water clearly can destroy the microphone. Wind can destroy the low frequency measurement. You must avoid the source of turbulence near the microphones. And according to the experience for people that used to measure very low frequencies, infrasound noise, for example, for nuclear blasts or nuclear experiment, we can use some dome for reduce the wind noise and be able to record the very infrasound, very low frequency noise. Also, in that case, we need the long-term deployments. We need to understand better how the noise on the surface change respective to time. About underground measurement, there are some problems also in underground measurement because there can be water leaks that can go on the sensor, so the sensor, the microphone must be protected from water leaks and so on. About the instrumentation, usually for our experience, we use some wide range infrasound microphone and some post-processing unit that allow to filter out some unwanted noise and to tailor the gain of the system. The cost, the tentative cost is about 22 kilo euros per per station. Taking account that when we use a digitizer for the seismic station, for example, surface or underground, usually this digitizer has many channels, three channels, six channels, so we can share a digitizer together for acquiring seismic signals and acoustic signals. Maybe doubling the number of sensors, for example, two microphones at half a meter, could be useful to remove the wind effect, but this has to be confirmed with some tests. Slide number 9, we give some example for the magnetic measurement. The magnetic measurement are mainly the Schumann resonances. In the 8-60 Hz range, the level of these Schumann resonance signals are very low because they lie between 0.1 and 1 picotesla, 5 tesla. And so we need a very sensitive device. Then it's useful also to have a measurement for the lightning magnetic disturbance, and this is a broadband signal that stay from zero, say, up to some so few kilohertz. This is important because it is a, in case of magnetic of a giant lightning can be seen, the signal can be seen by all the gravitational wave sensors. And then another important measurement is the effect of the magnetic properties of the rocks underground and their effect on the magnetic fields. In the plot bottom, you can see typical Schumann resonances level that stay between 10 to the minus 3, 10 to the minus 4 nanotesla. So in the region, the sensitivity must be very good. Slide number 10 is about the installation best practice. Usually when we go in surface, the sensor must be buried because the wind can add a lot of noise to the magnetic sensor. So they must be placed a few centimeters underground, usually half meter. We think it's better to use to record the three axes. So we need the three mono-axis instruments because we want to record the whole field. K must be used to prevent the water or immersion. This is very important because also in that case, the sensor must remain in underground position for at least 1 year, I say. So we must avoid on the long term the pollution from water. Another important aspect to be considered is that must be a long distance from electronic and power supply. Otherwise, they will pollute the signals, the magnetic signals we want to see, to record. In Virgo, we have always used some Metronics magnetic sensor, and they are perfectly equivalent to the LIGO sensor that are the Lemmy 120. So we have experience with both of these kind of sensor. They are broadband, you can configure for a recording from 1 millihertz to 1 kilohertz, or if needed from 10 hertz to 10 kilohertz. Also in that case, the digitizer, the same digitizer used for seismic and microphone, can be used also for the magnetic field. Clearly, usually digitizer have a finite number of channels, 3-6 channels, so maybe this is not possible when you have 3 magnetometers, 1 microphone, a couple of seismic sensors, so it's depend. So the cost is a tentative cost for each sensor is 6 kilo euro. Then if needed, another digitizer that can span from 6 to 10 kilo euro. What we told about the cost is summarized in table in slide 11, when we write down all the kind of sensor for the seismic, magnetic and acoustic. So some of them are no more available. There is new models, but more or less, as you can see, we span always in the starting from 10 kilo euro from the seismic sensor and going up to 45 for the nanometrics. Then we do not know yet the costs for the borehole kind of seismic sensor, but we will investigate on this. As I told, the magnetic sensor is 6 kilo euro, and then acoustic need microphone 2 kilo euros and the post-processing unit 10 kilo euros. Then there are the data logger. I know that we do not use in Vigo the Quantera, but is very used from geophysics people. This is costs 10 kilo euro, while the Nanometrics Centaur, that is a 6-channel digitizer, costs 6 kilo euro. So this is the last slide, 12. Thank you for your attention. Please, if any questions, I'm ready.
Great, thanks very much. That was a very nice overview. Questions for Federico?
Federico, here Lino, but the cost of the acoustic sensors is 2 kilo euro? Because you said before in the slide that it was 22 kilo euro with digitizer. So.
Yes, when I say 22 kilo euro, and it's because I include the digitizer, then the post-processing, then a couple of microphones. So the microphone by itself doesn't cost really a lot, because you know it's about 1,000 euros, 1 kilo euro for microphone. But the post-processing unit is about 10 kilo euro. Then you have 6 kilo euro in case of the Centaur Nanometrics, or another 10 kilo euro for the Quantera. So at the end, if you need everything, because you can't shade the digitizer, you go up to more than 20 kilo euro.
Other questions for Federico?
Yeah.
Maybe I can throw a couple questions and comments. And so one comment, I know that the Nikkev people bought for a borehole a sensor, so they should have, you know, if you send an email to Alessandro Bertolino, for example, I'm pretty sure he can give you a price on at least the sensor they bought, which I'm not sure which of the ones on your list it is, but I mean they should have a price ready.
Okay, perfect. Yes, I will ask Alessandro information about the borehole.
Yeah. The other question I had about, I mean, you said when you talked about the magnetic stuff, you said that you want to measure also the underground effect of the rock magnetic properties on the magnetic fields. So I was just wondering, how does that actually work? I mean, if you have the sensors, you know, obviously, you know, can easily look at the spectrum and understand whether, you know, there are lots of magnetic fields or little. But how do you then go from that to infer something about the magnetic properties of the rock? Can you talk a little bit about how that works?
Truly speaking, not very well, because this was a hint given by Marco Olivieri, that is a geophysicist that knows better than me these topics. I guess that is simply moving the location and the ground and seeing if the spectra is more or less the same or if it's depending of the location and the ground. Maybe this measuring the native properties. Or maybe, I'm not an expert on this kind of magnetic instrument, simply seeing the variation of the magnetic earth.
There's a strong echo coming from Luciano Di Fiori. Can you please mute?
No, Luciano. Okay, so sorry, but not much detail on this kind of measurement because it's more a geologist affair. So I will ask details on the hints that has given to me by Marco Olivieri.
Yeah, don't worry, it was really kind of mainly for my own curiosity to understand.
Okay.
One question.
Important. I mean, I can only guess that is or because you want to measure in different location on the ground and to see if the spectra is varying, it's changing, or because you want to see the magnetic, the field of the Earth, magnetic, if it's changing also the static one, I mean. If it's changing by position, I don't know. Could be one of the two.
I think there was a comment from Ricardo.
Yeah, I wanted to know. One of the things that I think you should look at if there are power lines or such around there, because to my knowledge, the magnetic field noise underground, unless you have magnetic materials in the rock is just given by the solar wind pushing on the Earth magnetic field lines and push them around. So doing it at the surface and not at the surface and at depth and comparing the two, I don't know how relevant it may be. It's better than nothing, but if you are only at the surface, all you get is the solar wind pushed around by the magnetic field pushed around by the solar wind.
Well, the solar wind should be one of the reason for the Schumann resonance, if I'm not mistaken. I mean, going deep underground, we are far from the power lines. The hope is to be far from the power lines, so to be less polluted by signals of this kind. And so maybe we can easily see better the Schumann resonances. We had some measurement, for example, in Sardinia, because for the time being there is a magnetometers about 300 meters underground that is continuously recording one axis. So now we have to download the data and to have a look. But I think it's interesting because we can have a good measurement of what is really underground about the magnetic field far from the power mines, because at least you are 100 meters far. But we still have to download data and to have a look to this sensor in Sardinia.
What I was suggesting is to have a sensor at the surface that takes the data at the same time in the same axis, and then you can compare the two, have sort of an attenuation function of the rock in that place.
I agree perfectly with you. Absolutely. We need not one measurement per time, but simultaneous measurement on surface and underground, because it's the best way to better understand what's going on. I absolutely agree.
Can I throw in another couple of questions? So one thing I was wondering about is... Yeah, Fulvio, please you go ahead.
Okay. So as far as I remember, an action in this direction was attempted in Kagra with no success, if I am not wrong. So probably we should inquire our colleagues in Kagra what they did, what was the problem that they faced.
Yes, indeed. Yes. We can ask to our colleague about the measurement they had in the past, maybe 1 or 2 years ago. Mm. Yeah, 2 years ago, maybe.
Yeah, it was shown.
Yes, we can have a look to their measurement and compare also to the one we are running in Sardinia.
But the purpose will be characterize from a magnetic point of view the rocks and see if we can have a better shielding from the rocks. I mean, what would be the purpose of this measurement?
Now, the main purpose is to be sure that we can measure very well, for example, Schumann resonances and the lightning without be polluted by, also our instruments, because we need to bring down the supply, the mains supply, or also a DC power supply, but we can't rely only on batteries. So the risk is to pollute something, and this, for example, the one running in Sardinia is a test to see if it's easy to measure the magnetic field without being polluted by other signals, and so to be able to extract very well the Schumann resonances. Then, clearly, if you can do that, you can learn something more about the property. As Riccardo said, if we have a sense of the
Luciano, do you want to say something? Your microphone is open.
Oh, I'm sorry. It should not be. I'm sorry.
Okay, thank you. Can I ask a question about, I'm not so sure whether this applies to seismic sensors, but for the acoustic and the magnetic sensors, if you want to compare different sites, but if you have, like you suggested, for example, for the microphones, you have some different pre-amplifiers and pre-processors in there kind of doing some shaping and filtering, all of this kind of stuff. How do you think it's worthwhile thinking about any kind of, you know, calibrated acoustic or magnetic source that you can, you know, that one can easily, cheaply build in the same way and ship to different sites, just to make sure we are not fooling ourselves by, you know, the usual things, differential sending versus not differential sending, or having a high pass or low pass, or some funny filters in there that you know, somehow mess up your absolute levels?
Yes, for the microphone is a standard practice, because the seller of the microphone sell also the calibrator, if you want, because you must be traceable and you need the calibrator if you want to check between different sensors if they are in a good health and working well. I'm not aware about magnetic calibrators, but I think it's not a difficult task, because once you have some even current in a given number of turns, maybe you can have a calibrator, or at least the same one done in the same way for all the station in the world. I mean, I think it should be easy to intercalibrate and check the status of all the sensor. For the seismic, usually is done what is called a Hubble test. I mean, two or more sensor placed in the same place, and a long-term measurement on teleseism and something like that allow to understand if the sensor are in a good health and well calibrated, what I know. But anyhow, I agree with you that is a good practice to have a calibration, intercalibration of sensors, whatever kind they are.
Okay, and what I hear is more or less there will be some words or some section in your report or document on that. Any other questions for Federico and the other members of Working Group 2?
Just Irene, that is here with us now, she was just looking at the seller of the magnetometers, and she found that Medtronic sell calibration units, magnetic calibration units. So it's a standard practice also for magnetometers, not only for microphones.
Yeah, that sounds very good. And yeah, as you said, it can't be too complicated to have this. So I think that's something might be worthwhile investing, so just that we don't fool ourselves by factors of two or whatever. Great, thank you.
Thank you.
With that, let's thank Federico and the team, and let's move over to Lino. I post the slides of Working Group 3. There's a link in the chat window, and over to Lino, please.
Yeah, thank you, Stefan. I want to report on the ongoing activities for the Working Group 3. You see at the slide the number 2, the scope of the Working Group 3 is to evaluate those the parameters on the site that has an influence on infrastructural and geological point of view. Now this should include all the parameters that has, as I brought here, has impact on infrastructure cost, detector operation, the lifetime of the detector, and the safety of the worker that will stay at the site. And the output of this working group is a document. It's a document that we have organized as following. We have a first section where a detector requirements from science-driven requirement are reported. Then a general list of site parameters divided in 4 classes. Sometimes these are overlapping classes, but by the way, are surface, underground, safety, and lifetime. Followed by a detailed list that contains also descriptions, the context. And then we thought it can be useful to have a section where information or lesson learned from other surface underground facilities are reported. Slide number 4. we know. Well, a lot of work has already been done for the ET since several years, of course, but I think that we still need to freeze some important parameters that are necessary to define the infrastructure. We expect to have a lifetime of 50 years for such infrastructure, and I think this is a reasonable number. But we should define what is the topology of the detector that has an impact on infrastructure. The detector depth now is a few hundred meters depth, but we should decide what is this depth, and so on. To decide if we want to have a threshold for seismic noise, spectral requirements to qualify the site. And this, I don't know, maybe using what was proposed by Becker some years ago, making this, of course, this should be done, the seismic characterization then should be done at the 3 detector corners underground. We will see more later. If we want to have a requirement on the earthquakes frequency, how many earthquakes we want to have at site, because this will have an impact on the detector operation, on the duty cycle of operation. And then, of course, we want to know if there is a stability requirement tunnels and caverns. This may have a strong impact on the infrastructure. Let me give an example. A LEP tunnel had a very strong requirements on the stability because they had a requirement on position of the pipe for LEP that was 0.1 millimeter. So they had to do a lot of work and design of the underground infrastructure to meet this requirement. Of course, there is a cover site also. It's very important for the site selection also, and so on. So it is very important to define such parameters. Slide number 5. I of course I will not go through all the parameters that we are adding in our documents. Just to give an example, for surface, we need to analyze the surface condition, the land usage, the ground stability, the interference analysis with human activities, and see where are cities, roads, and access to, and define, see what is the best access to the underground facilities. All these things goes in this group of parameters for the site qualification. Slide number 6, if we go to the underground parameters, very, very important is to define the position of dislocation and faults in the underground. This is very important because we may a site could be not good enough, let me say, if there are a big dislocation, very diffused dislocation faults, because you can it then will be very difficult to have a big caverns. And then we have all these parameters, the rock mass classification, the strength parameters, that classify the how the waves travel and the rocks and so on. If you go to slide number 7, another very important aspect is the hydrogeological data about the site. Because this has a huge impact on the infrastructure, on the construction, on the way of the tunnels are the supported and so on. So this is of course very, very important. Also for the safety. I just told me somebody that in the Gran Sasso laboratories, since there is a lot of water on the mountain, side of the mountain, and there are faults, so there is the risk of flooding the laboratories. So the people there are diving masks and diving cylinders available for people working there in case of earthquake, because there is a risk to have the laboratory is full of water. So this is very important to take in account this aspect. Slide number eight, the safety, this is what I was saying for water, but also we have to consider radioactivity for the safety of the worker there. And the main the radioactivity level comes mainly from radon and thoron. There are laws about the concentration of indoor radon. But this radon should be measured not only on rocks, but also the radon outside. on the surface of the site, because the radon can enter and reaching the underground site through the ventilation system. This happens other sites, or the radon can enter through the groundwater. So it's necessary to make this investigation, and even is also important the construction materials. Because maybe the rocks there has a low level of radon, but construction materials has been used that has a high content of radon, and so, and this at the end will affect could affect the ventilation system that needs to be to replace air and remove the radon. So to take care also about radioactivity for the operation of the of the detector. Slide number 9. Lifetime, as I said, is 50 years, and since it's quite a long period, we should consider to have a corrosion plan about infrastructure, but also about the detector itself. Considering humidity, the acidity, chemicals, elements. For example, if we use stainless and steel, is particularly sensitive to chloride, that can induce a strong corrosion, so we have to be careful on that. But not only, we have also microbiological influenced the corrosion, so bacteria that can speed up the corrosion factor 100. And also AC induced corrosion. If we have a high voltage electric power line on surface, this can induce differential potential even at deep pipe, metallic pipe, and this can increase corrosion. I mean, there are cases reported in literature about this. So, slide number 10. And the last section of the document will be, I mean, we will report some case about the experience about other facilities. And we are collecting some information from CERN. We are in touch with the engineering department, thanks to Riccardo. So, for example, it's interesting to know that they have a ventilation that replaces one volume per hour. So this is quite a strong ventilation, but in this way, this is enough to keep the humidity under control, so they don't control the humidity, just the ventilation. And they had some corrosion problem for bellows and for cryogenic system due to chloride. They use stainless steel. Let me then, if you go to slide number 12, these are site parameters. Let's say the difference among sites can translate in additional costs and longer realization times, comparing one site with the other, or the difference among sites can affect detector performance. So we can basically, let me say, we could divide all the parameters in these two big groups, cost parameters and performance parameters. The cost parameters, well, this is a personal view that for such complex project like an underground structure IT, a reasonable approach would be to ask specialized company that makes makes underground structure to make a detailed design that include a risk management plan. This is the way how to have a really a realistic cost of the structure. And then, of course, there are performance parameters that should be defined and addressed by the people involved in the detector design. If you go to number 14, the cost, as is the risk management plan, is very important for such a big structure, underground structure, and because this involved a very detailed knowledge of the geological, hydrogeological characteristics of the site at small scale level. To take in account possible problem like rock burst that happens in hard rock, deformation in soft rock, mud flow, water rush, all these kind of uncertainties that you have for such kind of works, and you should try to reduce as much as possible this kind of uncertainties. You go to slide number 15, this is what I said, and this requires a really detailed knowledge of the underground. Slide number 16, I put here this picture that impressed me a lot. Well, you see that there is a gallery that was excavated, and then due to a variability of geological condition, the gallery was squeezed, pressing the rock, and the diameter reduced by a factor 2, more or less. So they had to remine and so on. The example in the left tunnel, they involved companies, big companies, the best companies worldwide, doing this kind of this kind of work. They did a very extensive characterization of the underground. They did even an exploration tunnel of 4 kilometers to go and see the transition from molass to limestone, to different, the limestone was under the Jura mountain. And they had a 2 years program of test borings, 9 kilometers vertical boreholes. Total, they drilled 9 kilometers, and one borehole was 1 kilometers deep. Nevertheless, they had problems going under the Jura. They know that there were problems, and indeed they reduced the size of the lap of the ring from 30 kilometers to 27 to avoid as much as possible the Jura. But by the way, they had problems, water rush, mud flow, and they had the 8 months delay and cost. So this just is an example to say that this is a complex, we all know that it's complex, this kind of job. So, slide number 18. Let me say that to compare the infrastructure costs, if we want to compare sites, and means also the cost related to the sites, we need a detailed design that includes a very detailed geological and hydrogeological investigation and a risk management plan. For parameters, certainly we agree that we need to measure underground seismic site, to characterize from a seismic point of view the location at the place where will be our foreseen the corner of the detector, because you can have a local enhancement seismic noise. So we should know exactly, more or less exactly, in that point, what happens. Slide number 19, just a few slides to see if we look at the AT roadmap that say that is reported that the site qualification should end early 2021. You go at slide 20. So there is not so much time left. We think to give a first draft of the working group 3 document before the summer break, but we should take in account that a geological and hydrogeological campaign reasonable takes a couple of years. And my personal question is, should this campaign be made by a company that will make a detailed design? Because these are everything related. I see it difficult to divide things, because the companies knows what to do, what to see, and they take also the responsibility of what they write at the end. And also, related to timing, we need, as Federico said, we need a long-term characterization, seismic site characterization, be at least 1 year, possibly underground, at detector corners. So that's all what I want to say. Thank you.
Yeah, great. Thank you very much, Lino, for this nice overview. Questions, please, for Lino. Okay, then I simply start with one comment. I think everybody who thought about it agrees that companies play the key role in doing kind of a detailed analysis of all of this. So I think everybody is aware of that, and nobody from the gravitational wave community has the intention to, you know, to step outside our range of expertise and do anything in geology and so on. So I think that's a clear message. Can I ask? It's not really clear for me. So what really is in the end in your document? So let's take a simple example. So one of the parameters that we can all easily understand what it is, you said, is the humidity in the caverns, for example, and then obviously that derives from that some ventilation requirements and so on. So will your document list simply, yes, this is a parameter that is important, and put, you know, a little bit of narrative around it, why it is important and what are the things to watch out for? Or is your target to actually then in the end have in the document a requirement of, let's say, saying, you know, humidity cannot be above this and this percent?
Clear. This will be nice to have this number, of course, but then you need to know, for example, what kind of material will be the pipe. It will be 304L stainless steel or not, because this depends. That's why there are a lot of parameters or information that should be defined. And if you define that, you can try to then to even put some threshold, some value for some of the parameter. Of course, this is always possible, but if there are enough information, it would be nice to have such a number, and we would like to put such a number.
Yeah, I think it's probably a bit of the hen and egg problem. I mean, that, you know, all of these things are somehow interlinked, and you know, the vacuum complex. People will argue and saying, you know, okay, we wait for the site requirements people to tell us what is the humidity, and then we can decide whether, you know, any kind of cheaper steel is an option, or whether we have to go for the more expensive stuff to sustain the higher humidity.
In the specific case, of course, there are other parameters that drive the choice. Of course, the cost and the kind of material and here we can, of course, take his previous experience. For example, at GEO 600, I think they use very good stainless steel, the 316, I think. I don't know if Harald is online. Thin corrugated stainless steel was very good. And this is in the trench. This is a very bad condition, but they didn't have any corrosion problem up to now. That is very interesting. I mean, the choice of material is a complex matter, and
okay. I mean, I just put the humidity as an example. So the ambition is to really kind of describe the parameters, but then also where possible to set, you know, guidelines or requirements of where these parameters should sit, what is an acceptable range. That is my understanding.
Yeah, and of course, such documents as continuous evolution, I suppose, will keep changing and adding information, of course.
One of the things that, in my opinion, we should keep in mind and put a constraint on it concerns the assembling procedure of the vacuum tubes, because assembling procedures in some sense is directly linked with the dimension of the tunnel. This is an aspect that we should keep in mind by defining at least what are the constraints that are coming from this assembly procedure, both in terms of space in terms of safety. How we can manage in a tunnel of 10 kilometers assembly procedure in a safety way, because this could set in principle limits in how we have to build the tunnels and caverns.
Yeah, I agree, Fulvio. I agree completely, and I think this should go in detailed design documents. Will be part of that. You must take in account in the detailed design of the site aspect.
At least we need to have in the same room discussing this aspect the vacuum experts with the civil engineers.
Yes, I think everybody agrees on this, and I think that's what Lino had in one of his last slides, where he said, you know, we should get the companies on board. So I think we are all in violent agreement on that. Other questions or comments for Lino? Can I ask one again on these on the radon you had in there, this kind of 100 becquerel per cubic meter? I'm still not clear after talking with several people about, you know, how these things are handled. Are these kind of guidelines that come from somewhere? Is that a legal regulation? Is that a legal regulation which which kind of is a hard value, or does it depend on whether you expect people to be there and being able to work there all the time? Or, for example, thinking of, you know, is there, could, you know, could one design some kind of valuable or variable ventilation rate system, which where you say, you know, you put in some big fans which are very noisy, you know, once you want to do some maintenance and get people down into the tunnel, and then during science mode when nobody is down there, actually you switch off or reduce your ventilation so that it fulfills the humidity requirement, but you know the radioactivity goes a little bit higher up, but it doesn't matter because nobody is down there. How does all of this work? Are there kind of very strict legal rules, or is there some leeway for us to play and make concepts?
No, these are legal rules for places where people work. Actually, well, the Wolfango is the expert on that. I read only something about that. So if people stay there for a long period, then this is, I think, quite strict limit. But the amount of radioactivity, as you said, can be regulated by ventilation. And we have to see if this ventilation then for sure increase noise detector. But then we have to know, because maybe the ventilation will be driven, the speed, the amount of air removed by ventilation will be driven not by radioactivity, but by the humidity, to keep the humidity at a reasonable level, to avoid or condensation, water on electrical. My feeling, I am not an expert, but my feeling is that we probably have to, that this will put the constraint on ventilation.
Okay, I see. Thank you. Any other urgent questions for Lino? Because I realize we are more or less out of time. We are above an hour now. If that is not the case, I would have hoped we get to a little bit of updates or summaries from maybe Michele or Harald, but both of them seem not to be around, on the GWADW meeting, and in particular the outcomes of the Dawn 5. I put onto the wiki page the link, so I can just encourage everybody to have a look at the slides there. There were quite some interesting discussions, obviously more scientific on GWADW and more political on the Dawn meeting. And I think it will be interesting to see, for the Dawn meeting, there will be, I think, as usual, a written report. So that will be something I'm pretty sure we will discuss in one of the later meetings. Are there any other news updates anybody wants to bring to the attention of the rest of the collaboration? If that is not the case, then thank you all for joining. Thanks to Lino and Federico again for presenting, and talk to you all next month. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.